Good morning. Here is the fantastic Mr. Fox with the conundrum of the week.
Nobody knows what's going to happen on Christmas Day. And I can guarantee you, it's in my family, your family, every family on the island is going, what? What are we going to do with numbers? I mean, what do we do?
Well, as of yesterday, this is what we do. On Tuesday, hit the gym, buy the guna, get the hair done, go to church or a museum, maybe play a game of tennis or golf. Eating and drinking, though, on hold until Friday, and the pub, not happening. And from December 18th to January 6th, it's inter-county travel time, with up to 3 households gathering for the dinner. But personal responsibility is being urged. In other words, don't act the maggot. Here is Taoiseach Micheál Martin in his address to the nation yesterday evening.
In easing restrictions, we are going as far as we believe it is possible to achieve the best balance of health, economic and social considerations, but no further. The government and I are satisfied that this combination of new arrangements strikes a safe balance between maintaining the pressure on the disease and creating space for families, friends and loved ones to be together this Christmas.
And he spoke about risk.
In our interactions over the coming period, each one of us has the responsibility to manage risk. After 9 months of learning about how this virus is spreading in our community, one overwhelming lesson has emerged. Every contact counts. If we want to stop the virus, we must continue to limit contacts outside of a small circle.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin in his address to the nation yesterday evening, and risk seems to be the watchword. And all week long, anticipation of what might happen and questions as to how we could safely navigate Christmas dominated the airwaves. Because you see, my level of acceptable risk may not chime with yours. Here's psychologist Stella O'Malley with Claire on Wednesday.
My version of safety is different to your version of safety. And up until now, you and I could rock along quite happily with my version of safety being different. But now my version of safety impacts your life. And so you can become furious because I'm not being as safe as you are. Mm-hmm. And so that's this really pernicious part of the lockdown, is that you can't rock along nicely with people with different, and everybody has a different assessment of risk and safety.
And of course, they're all the questions we're going to be asking as a country in the next week or so as we head towards the 1st of December.
And it's causing huge fights within families about Christmas dinner, about what we should be doing, about who should be doing that, or who should be visiting. It's really, really become incredibly combative. And can we just kind of acknowledge that none of us are feeling okay? And some of us, when we're feeling fragile and vulnerable, we go straight into fight. And I feel there's a lot of fight brewing. I hear it among clients about what to do over Christmas, because different people's assessment of risk is slamming up against each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one person is saying, well, I'm doing this, and they're saying, well, you can't do that because that's my mother you're talking about. And there's utter war happening, and I think it's really important that we kind of take a breath and say, can we not? Can we just try and get through this with an acknowledgement of we're all feeling vulnerable and we might be more prone to fights and distress than ever before?
Ooh, rubber cutlery all round, perhaps. But when Professor Luke O'Neill spoke to Claire, he looked to the guidelines for Thanksgiving issued by the US Centre for Disease Control.
And just on, if you look at how the day would work, so if you arrive to your family's home and you're wearing your mask and you're doing your social distancing and everybody is behaving themselves as they should, then you sit down for dinner, you take off your mask and everybody is sitting there at the table as spaced as they can be. Are you just about to undo all of the good work that you did earlier on?
Well, again, the guidelines are in the CDC site and we know them in Ireland. So first of all, bring your own dinnerware, they're recommending, and then there's less touching of things, right? Have a single person in the kitchen doing all the serving, because the more people you have, the more chance it is it's going to spread. Stagger around the table. Don't sit opposite someone, have someone diagonal. And then there's a bit of distance between you, you know. Good ventilation is key, and then not too long. I mean, the difficult, it's going to be tough, let's face it. It won't be like any other Christmas ever. Keep it down to a minimum at a time, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't be having 10 hours in a stuffy room together playing family games. That's not going to work, you know. Okay. So again, it's kind of common sense.
And don't pass the gravy boat.
Don't pass the gravy boat, exactly. That kind of thing, yeah. Okay.
So one person does all the cooking while the rest of us stagger around the table and hog the tasty dishes. Nothing too new there. But what about this idea from a texter?
A number of us have decided to pay for private testing so we can relax at home with our parents for Christmas Day. Can you tell me, is this a good plan?
It's tricky, that as well, actually, to be honest. Because
it's a snapshot of a moment.
That's the problem.
Time.
If you take a test on the 21st of December and think you're clear, you could get infected between that and Christmas Day and then be infectious. You know, so it's very tricky. So now, are we saying take a test on Christmas morning? I don't know, because then there might be low-level infection. It's very hard. I think it's tricky enough to depend on testing. I wouldn't do that. Remember, we've got to remind people this is still a very dangerous virus, and keep that in your mind the whole time. And if you just try to, as we've been discussing, observe the things we've been saying, you'll decrease risk of it spreading and infecting your loved ones.
And speaking of loved ones.
And where do you stand on telling the 5-year-old child not to hug their grandmother?
That's too extreme. You can certainly hug briefly, wear masks, have a quick hug outdoors. Let's start with that. Mm-hmm. That's a low risk activity, really, you know, because, and they want to have a hug, don't they? So again, just keep in mind, minimise all these things. But at Christmas, surely we can allow these things to happen.
Professor Luke O'Neill. However, later in the week, Morning Ireland's Mary Wilson put it to psychologist Maureen Gaffney that maybe, just maybe, Granny didn't actually want the hug. Surely not.
Do we make assumptions around Christmas as well? We as families, you know, that Granny and Grandad want to come to our house for Christmas, and this notion that we'll put them sitting in the window with the window open and the wind howling around, you know, we're making the assumption without asking Granny and Grandad what they want to do.
Well, absolutely. I think the majority of grandparents will want to be with their families for Christmas, like they always are. But I think that one of the changes that happens as people get older is that they become more determined to make absolutely the best use they can of the time they have left in life. And for most people, that is spending time, and that there's really good evidence that what people, the older they get, the more they want to spend time with the people they really care about, which is their family and their close friends.
Ooh, here's hoping we'll make the cut. But how best to approach the easing of restrictions while not throwing away all our hard-won gains from level 5 was on all our minds. Claire asked WHO COVID envoy Dr. David Nabarro what he thought the virus might be doing for the Christmas.
You see, this virus doesn't celebrate Christmas. It doesn't take holidays at all. It just has really just one purpose in life, which is to multiply and spread itself. And so if humans spend a lot of time in the coming month being close together, physically close, socialising, perhaps in warm places without good ventilation, then it creates a really brilliant environment for the virus to spread. And we've just been going through, in the Irish case, level 5, we've managed to get levels of disease down. They've come down very nicely. And I think that what people like myself want to really encourage is that if we are going to start being social, that we manage to combine with it a healthy respect for the virus, and we don't end up with a big spike in cases in January or early February. And that's my request, is can we do Christmas and do Christmas really well, but at the same time keep the advantage that we've built up over this virus so effectively during the last 3 weeks.
That will be the test. But what were his thoughts on the opening of the wider hospitality sector and pubs in particular?
All the inquiries that have been done as to how the virus is spreading do suggest that there is a role for the hospitality sector that has to be understood and taken seriously. It doesn't happen everywhere. It doesn't happen every time. But you get these dramatic spreading events occurring as a result of a party or as a result of a night out of a group of friends. And then that just becomes the place where it happens. And we do believe still that really careful precautions in pubs and restaurants are absolutely critical. Then, of course, people say, well, that then defeats the whole objective. We want to go out, we want to have fun, we want to be close to each other. And you killjoys are coming along and saying, we've got to do it with physical distancing. But I think it's this year, you know, this is Christmas 2020, has to be different. We will have candidate vaccines available and being used in the coming months. It will be different in 2021. I can't say how it will be different, but I have to say we've seen how when people come together and mingle, that after a few weeks leads to a surge in cases of the virus, people getting sick, people dying. So if I can really have any influence on people, it will be to say, yes, have fun. Yes, meet the family, but respect the virus and do it in ways that really reduce the likelihood of clusters building up all over again.
That was Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO with Claire Byrne. However, when Neil MacDonald of Ismay spoke on yesterday's News at One, the prospect of another lockdown in January was not one he relished.
What do you make of, for example, the comments that we heard in recent days from the Tánaiste and others as well, that we may have to face some further restrictions in the new year as a consequence of this relaxation?
Well, that's precisely the issue we have, Brian. I mean, the vista before us is if we don't adopt a proper suite of control measures for this virus, we're simply going to yo-yo in and out of lockdown until we have a vaccine. And that isn't good enough. It's counter to the advice that the state is getting from the WHO. We are meant to be taking a much more aggressive approach to testing and tracing people. Mm-hmm. We're meant to be going down the road of rapid testing and response. And we're just not doing those things. NPHET is acting like a toolbox that only has a hammer in it. And we know that the hammer is effective, that hammer being lockdown, we know it's effective at flattening the curve, but it flattens everything else, jobs, incomes and society. We need something else.
But what about Northern Ireland, given that they're going into a 2-week hard lockdown just as we begin to relax our restrictions? Where does that leave cross-border travel? On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Áine Lawler spoke to Tommy Gorman.
It's not exactly the walking in tandem that medical experts have been calling for.
No, phase two has been a mess because it has been a case of regulation light up here with the very obvious consequences. But I think there was a moment of truth last week when the DUP as well as got online and got on board with everybody else to say we have to tighten things. And I'd say it'll be interesting to see what is the impact of that 2 weeks of tightening. And I suppose there is a fear, maybe not fully grounded, that when Northern Ireland is locked down, you'll see people flocking south of the border to do their shopping, etc., etc., or to use the facilities, to use the pubs, or to use the restaurants if they're let open. I don't think the pubs will be let open. But I think because of the price factor, you won't see a huge element of that. And I just don't think it's anywhere realistic, or I think intended by Leo Varadkar, that there would be a suggestion that Northerners living in the south will be told, well, you can't go up there because that's infected at a much higher level than in the south. I just don't think that's a reality.
Tommy Gorman with Áine on Thursday's Morning Ireland. And certainly when Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald spoke to Sarah on Drive Time, she didn't sugarcoat it.
Lockdown in Northern Ireland tomorrow while we're opening up next week. Dangerous, yep. Do you think?
Crazy is what I think. And I think I've said to you before, Sarah, that what we need on this small island is the single all-island approach. It's manifestly ludicrous that we have lockdowns and opening up at different speeds and at variance with each other on a small island.
However, in a week that saw division and rancour among the political parties on a whole variety of issues, on one, at least, there was consensus.
Santa Claus has been designated an essential worker and will be allowed travel.
As Minister for Foreign Affairs, we've been working on the Santa Claus issue for a number of weeks now. And it's important to say to all children in the country that we regard Santa Claus's travels as essential travel for essential purposes, and therefore he is exempt from the need to self-quarantine for 14 days and should be able to come in and out of Irish airspace and indeed in and out of Irish homes without having to restrict his movement. But I am assured that children should not stay up at night because he does need to social distance. And so people need to keep at least 2 metres away at all stage to make sure that we keep him safe and indeed children as well. So he's exempt, he's coming, he's confirmed that, and he appreciates the fact that Ireland has ensured that in a very, very different Christmas in 2020, the visit of Santa Claus will be something that will remain consistent.
Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney in the Dáil with clarity on the Santa Claus issue. Back in a bit. Welcome back. It was a big week for sport. Cavan beat Donegal for their first Ulster title in 23 years. Tip beat Cork for the Munster title, their first since 1935. And on Morning Ireland, Killian Sherlock brought us this from Tipperary footballer and hurler Babs Keating, whose granduncle Tom Ryan was one of the Tipperary footballers on Bloody Sunday.
It was beyond belief, and yet there was something within us that the Bloody Sunday of 100 years ago would lift the spirits of the lads today. I dreamt about being a Tipperary footballer, and it was the Bloody Sunday team that influenced that generation of Tipperary teams and Tipperary footballers and club footballers. And I knew at least 6 or 7 of them in my early days. And then my granduncle, like, he was a man that we all looked up to. So you can understand the joy and the tears that came when I saw Conor Sweeney lifting that cup today. It was brilliant.
A proud Babs Keating. And then Mary Wilson spoke to former Tip footballer, all-star and manager of the under-21s, Declan Brown. And in the interests of full disclosure, Mary Wilson, Tip native, bias palpable.
Hiya, Mary. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Beyond belief, Babs Keating said, I'm happy, you're happy. Sum it up for us. What does it mean to guys like you? You came so close. And all the Tip men who've worn that jersey for so long. What does it mean to them and to the supporters?
It's absolutely incredible, Mary. You know, it's something we've all dreamed of. You know, you hear Babs there and even pre-Babs, like, there's players out there, you know, they've literally died for a jersey, and what a fitting occasion it was for Conor to lift it on Bloody Sunday weekend. But, like, for the likes of myself and my teammates and all that, like, we all tried in vain to achieve that, and we're jealous. There's no point in saying any different. We'd love to be in that situation. But what those guys did for us yesterday is indescribable. I'd say there was tears in every sitting room in Tipperary. You know, there's probably televisions broken and there was balls kicked, and no disrespect to Cork, but once Kerry were beaten, we felt we had a right chance of winning this, and that's the way it turned out.
Indeed it did. And later, Cavan man Hugh Horican spoke to Clare Byrne about their win over Donegal to gain their long-awaited Ulster title.
To lift the newspaper, all the newspapers, and see us on the headlines, and it was great for all them young lads. Like, Raymond Galligan's a fantastic captain. He is a great leader all year, but we had about 20 leaders there yesterday on the field. They all stood up. We got a black card. We went 7 points down. They never panicked. Then we got the referee will give us a bit of luck in the last quarter. Jesus, he gave us bad luck, another black card. and we outscored them in that period, you know. So you need luck to win matches, but believe me, there was no luck there yesterday. We were deserving champions.
Cavan man Hugh Horican with Clare on Cavan's great win. On Wednesday evening, the death was announced of footballing legend Diego Maradona at the age of 60.
Henrique to Maradona. Different class. Talked about the great players of World Championship football, this man will be on a pedestal. Diego Armando Maradona.
Maradona just walked away from Hoddle then. Maradona.
They're appealing for offside. Or was it a use of the hand that England are complaining about?
Play there as Redondo tries to go through. There's a show! Glorious goal! He's done it! Maradona! And look at these emotional scenes. there is something extra special about.
Maradona, lo marcan dos, pisa la pelota Maradona, arranca por la derecha el genio del fútbol mundial, y es el tercero a tocar para Borruchaga, siempre Maradona, genio, 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 ta, 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 ta.
Wow, era-defining goals there from Diego Maradona on that montage from Morning Ireland. When the news first broke, Cormac spoke to Liam Brady, who talked about Maradona's incredible talent and what it meant for his native Argentina.
He scored so many brilliant goals, Cormac. He won the World Cup for them in 86 in Mexico, where he was absolutely magnificent. He scored some brilliant goals. They knocked England out in that quarter final. Then they knocked Belgium out, and again he was the man that done all the damage, and he made the winning goal in the final against Germany. And then he went on to play in 1990. They got to the World Cup final again, Argentina, when Ireland did so well, getting to the last eight. They beat Italy in the semi-finals. And then again, he had in 94, but 94 kind of ruined him, didn't it? That's when they caught him taking recreational drugs and things like that. He obviously had his demons, his problems, and he probably didn't live his life in the healthiest kind of way. Yeah. But what a player, what a character.
And what was it like to play against him, Liam?
Very difficult. Very difficult. He was like a rubber ball. He had a very low centre of gravity. He could go any direction. He could twist and turn. He had a great vision of the football field. He could see a pass. He could dribble. He could actually do everything, you know, free kicks. He could bend them around the wall or strike them hard. And he could score any type of goal. I think, you know, we'll see now some of the goals that the man scored down through the years. Mm-hmm. And we can appreciate what a great, great player he was.
Liam Brady on Wednesday's Drive Time. The following morning, Des Cahill spoke to football writer Jonathan Wilson.
For somebody listening who's grown up on Ronaldo and Messi, how would you describe to them Maradona and his skills?
Enormously gifted as a footballer, you know, a phenomenal left foot, incredible balance, incredible awareness of those around him. You know, I think one of the things you really see looking back at those games for Argentina and for Napoli is that those were not teams made up of other great players. They were good players, but they weren't great players. But Maradona took them to that higher level with his inspiration, but also with his tactical intelligence, which I think is something that maybe at the time wasn't quite appreciated. The way he could manipulate a pitch, the way he had that vision of a whole sphere, and that enabled him to get the absolute utmost out of two sides who otherwise would have been, you know, relatively ordinary.
Later, Claire Byrne asked former Northern Ireland player and commentator Gerry Armstrong about that hand of God goal against England in the 1986 World Cup.
Yeah, it's the two extremes, you know, the one extreme, but they don't see that as anything wrong, you know, by flicking it and getting away with it. That's the cleverness of the South American players, and they see that as quite legal. But Maradona, he had the two extremes, and the second extreme is when he got the ball and he left four players just in his wake. He just went past them as if they weren't there, and he took it around the goalkeeper and stuck in the back of the net. He was a superb player, and, you know, I was fortunate enough to be in his company several times, and he's good company. He was good fun.
Oh, yeah, tell us about that. You went for a pint with him on occasion.
Went for a beer before he came. We were playing on the Sunday night in Barcelona, and the four Argentinian lads said, we're going to meet Diego for a quick beer before dinner. And we went out of the hotel and went across to the wee bar, and he was there. And we met him, and he told stories. And he's great, great fun, great entertainment. But I always tell people that he was the greatest player I ever played against, and George Best was the best player I ever played with. You know, the two of them were magicians, but they had so much ability, and the rest of us just could look on in awe at the specialness of both of them.
And later, Eamon Dunphy summed up the man and the talent.
You talk about how much he was adored. You say Pele was respected, but he was adored.
Yes, because I think he was an urchin.
he had a wonderful, beautiful face. He was strong, and so strong on the field. He could do things that no one else had ever done before and did them. And at the same time, he was vulnerable off the pitch, and people can identify with that. So some people you can identify with and the trouble they get into. And I think his people in Argentina and in Italy loved him for that. And the people he played with loved him because he was courageous. He was a leader. And he gave so much joy and wonder to people by his feats on the pitch that you wanted so much for him to have the comfort and, you know, the respect. He had the respect and the adoration, but he couldn't stay in at night, you know.
Was he the best player of his generation? Was he the best player of his century?
He was the best player of his generation. There's no question about that. And it was a great generation of players. You shouldn't really distinguish between so many of them. They are all incomparable. And he was incomparable. No one was ever better at playing the beautiful game of football than he was.
Eamon Dunphy with Claire Byrne on the late, great Diego Maradona. Back in a bit. Welcome back. If you think time has been doing something funny during the pandemic, slow, intense, kind of weird, you're not wrong. Here's Paul Dalton, Associate Professor of Psychology at UCD and Principal Clinical Psychologist at St Vincent's University Hospital, and he joined Cormac and Sarah on Monday's Drive Time.
Days can feel like weeks, weeks can feel like months, and then all of a sudden it can feel like a couple of seconds. That there is that, I think, the experience of kind of COVID time, where COVID has kind of created its own kind of clock. And the normal things, those things that kind of orient and places in the world, we don't have them anymore. So we're kind of dislocated, you know, we're cognitively dislocated. And the really important thing, you know, the human brain, it needs anchors. It needs milestones. It needs things to kind of to give our lives a sense of rhythm. And before COVID, the kind of the BC, we had many of these in to punctuate our days, to punctuate our lives. And without them, we are in a bit of a time warp. There's no doubt about that. And we've got to remember, I think this is really important, that we are living with an incredibly serious disease that has taken over. You know, I mean, vast number of people, over 2,000 people nationally, 1.4 million people globally. And what happens is we're living with an anxiety, and when we live with anxiety, when we are afraid, our sense of time gets very distorted. Mm. So if we find ourselves in a situation where we're scared, we lose track of time. People have found themselves in an accident, for example. They'll sometimes say things like, "It felt like it was happening in slow motion." So when we are afraid, our perception of time is really, really it's unsettled and it's distorted, and therefore the kind of day that feels like a week, the week that feels like a day.
Oh yes, Groundhog Day. Because while routine can be anchoring, too much routine can be deadening. Our brains crave stimulation, the shock of the new.
We human beings, we love novelty. We love things that are new. We seek them out. So we go on holidays, we plan holidays, we love new food, music, museums. We're seeking them out. And you'll see that behaviour in a toddler who makes its way around the floor. It's looking for the new shiny thing. That's what we do. We're hardwired to seek novelty. And of course, as you say, this has been really restricted over the last 8 or 9 months. And that lack of novelty impacts on the human brain. There's no doubt about that. That creates that kind of, that daze or that kind of time warp. And I also think there's something, you know, about where the kind of the Zoom quizzes and the sourdough, they're just not cutting the mustard anymore. Like it's not doing it for us. And without that, you know, we have to find other ways.
Okay,
of
so
doing
can you
that.
Talk us through that then? Because when you were talking about how routine is really important, all I was thinking was, well, I have my routine, and my routine is I go to playground A or I go to playground B.
Exactly.
And that's all I can do at the weekend. You know, or I go to the shop.
And you know, for so long, people like me talked about the importance of routine, and there is a real place for that in our lives in non-COVID times. But actually needing to create kind of anti-routine, that there needs to be in what we can do within our 5K to do that sensibly, but actually needing to break the routine. When we don't have new and novelty, we don't create memories in the same way.
Psychologist Dr. Paul Dalton on Drive Time. Now, if you're one of the 5 million people who tuned into the RTE podcast, The Nobody's Own, you'll be happy because they have fresh developments. So much so that this week saw the release of Episode 7, New Evidence. Here's presenter Tim Hinman picking up on alleged serial killer Kieran Kelly's confession that the first murder he ever carried out was that of his best friend, Christy Smith.
Just sit down, have a quick count up in your own mind about the ones you think you have killed, about the ones you think you might have killed, and how many you're sure you've killed.
The big question that the whole series asked was whether or not Kieran Patrick Kelly actually did murder 13 or 14 or even 15 people. Many of the people he claimed to have murdered never got justice and were simply forgotten. But not all of them. And one of them in particular we couldn't forget, because it was the one that Kelly said had started it all, Christy Smith. And we have found new information about Christy Smith.
You usually come back to Christy Smith because that's where it all starts.
That's I would have never mentioned none of them, but I just wanted to look at it.
You really want to get Christy Smith off your mind, don't you?
Ooh, Horty podcast, The Nobody's Own. Compelling stuff. On Tuesday, Ray Darcy spoke to John Healy, the maitre d' from the TV show The Restaurant. He's the recipient of a donor heart, and he's just gotten married.
How you doing, John? Congratulations.
Better late than never, I suppose, Ray. Thanks very much. How are you?
Can I tell them your age? Is that okay?
Go on. So yeah. Everybody knows it now anyway.
Yeah, 55. 55.
55, yeah. There's hope for everybody, yes.
Yes, and when did you marry your van?
We got married, it'll be 2 weeks tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
And how did you meet?
We met online, actually, about 5 years ago.
Okay.
And he had just arrived in Ireland about a month previous to that. And we kind of hooked up over Christmas time. I'd been working and he'd been working. And we just clicked immediately, you know.
Yeah.
I went off to Australia in February that year, the next year. And when I got back in March, we reconnected again. And he's still there. He hasn't ran.
Who proposed to who?
You know, it was kind of a complicated issue because of... I was actually quite ill, and we were in Spain.
Right.
And I go through bouts of illness with the transplant and medication and stuff. So, and we were sitting there, and I began to feel well at the end of the holiday. So I turned around and said to him, "My God," I said, "we really should do something about this, because if that hadn't happened to me, you'd have nothing."
Right.
And he turned to me, he looked at me, and went, "I do."
That's one way to do it. That was John Healy with Ray. Now, if you like your TV glossy, you might be watching The Undoing with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant from the TV god David E. Kelly. It centres on a New York woman married to a high-flying doctor who may or may not be guilty of a violent murder. And it's adapted from the novel You Should Have Known by Jean Hanf Korolitz. And she spoke to Sean Rocks on Monday. Now, just to give you an idea of the kind of high gloss we're talking about, the apartment in which the series is filmed was recently put on the market for $30 million.
There's rich and then there's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
I was able to see the inside of the house during one filming day. And I got to tell you, you know, I always knew just before I saw any of it that when it aired, it was going to be about the house, the hair, and the coats. I mean, these were the three things that people were going to be obsessed about, and I was right about all three.
Now, as it happens, Corlitz is married to our own poet, Paul Muldoon.
You know, does the Pulitzer Prize poet ever say, you're writing a mystery? Oh, you're writing a thriller?
Yeah, well, that's an issue that I've had, you know, the genre issue, as I like to call it, that I've had since the beginning of my career. You know, I started out as a poet, and then I stopped writing poetry for reasons that should be obvious, but my heart was really in fiction. You know, I kind of think of myself as a literary novelist who just loves plot. In my early years, when I was writing literary fiction that nobody was publishing, part of the reason nobody published it was that nothing ever happened. And in the books that I love to read, things happen. And the more surprising they are when they happen, the better. So I find myself in, you know, across this divide in this, the world of mystery and thrillers. But in my own mind, I'm still what I always was, which is a kind of a maker of sentences and stories.
From my perspective, there's no such thing really as high or low art in that regard. It's just not an issue. I mean, I myself don't think of the thriller or the detective story, for example, as been operating at a lesser pitch. Is it interesting? Does it work? These are the only questions.
And given that Corlitz wrote the book on which the TV series is based, surely when they sit down together to watch it, they know what's going to happen.
I mean, at one point last night, Paul said to me, was the lawyer like that in your book? And he said, well, there was no lawyer in my book. There was no Jonathan in my book.
Well, we're getting a bit confused. And anybody might have done it. And that, of course, is one of the glories of this genre. I mean, one's sitting, scratching one's head, thinking, could it have been her?
I don't think it was her.
Jean Hanf Corlitz and Paul Muldoon on the TV series The Undoing, as heard on Arena. Meanwhile, over on The Book Show, Ricochet and Stephanie Preisner knew exactly what they wanted from Santa. More.
I sometimes enjoy reading books, and when I do enjoy reading books, I want more of them once I'm finished. And I don't really want to like pick up another book and have to get to know another author. It's like going on a first date again. I'd rather go on a second date with someone I already know that I like. But some authors just refuse to give me what I want. You know, there are authors like, let's say, Patricia Cornwell or whatever. She writes about Kay Scarpetta. It's nice to get back into bed with your book and your character that you know. But then there are things like, you know, Harry Potter, obviously, where you'd like another book. And then there are authors like, let's say, J.K. Rowling, where she stops writing Harry Potter, people are like, we want more. And she's like, I'm not giving you more, but I'll give you this casual vacancy. And then we all cry into our pillows and waste €18 on a hardback copy.
Okay, so what about the idea, though, that less is more sometimes?
Well, I suppose as a writer, less is more. You want to keep your audience wanting more, so you write less, or else you kind of go out on a, you know, you're like, okay, I'm on a high now, so I'll just stop right here and we'll call me a genius. But as a reader, less is not more. You're looking at me as if there's something wrong with me. Well, no, but like, you're pathologizing something which is very normal. I want more of what I enjoy.
Rick, though, he's read too much, man. Been burned before.
I think sometimes about disappointment. So I think, for instance, that, you know, for every book that does live up to your expectations for something that you previously loved, there can be a Go Set a Watchman. If you loved To Kill a Mockingbird, which I didn't read, but which everybody I know who read was disappointed by. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think there's a single book I know that I would like an author to write more of that particular book. Not since I think I was a kid. And since I loved Enid Blyton, and I was really disappointed when I found out that she died in 1968 and therefore couldn't write any more of the books that I loved, I don't think I've felt that since then.
Well, aren't you just great and really content in yourself? And yes, okay, it is disappointing if you really, really want another book and then they bring one out and it's not as good. But is it too much to ask that they bring out something good again?
The last Enid Blyton manuscript discovered in a secret cove, perhaps. The Book Show. Getting all greedy and a little bit petulant. And if they were being naughty, Wine Tuberty was all about the nice.
It's just a thing when you hear what he's brought to the world, whether it's the Golden Ticket or Mr. Fox or Matilda or the BFG, all of these creations, a little bit dark, very joyful, lots of reward for children. These are the reasons why the toy show's theme would be The Wonderful World of Roald Dahl.
Indeed it was. And after last night's hijinks, Toyman Turbity is probably asleep, under his velvet fantastic Mr. Fox jacket, for it was a very special 2020 toy show on the telly. But on the run-up to it on the radio all week, Ryan was, shall we say, excited.
Give us another missing word.
Christmas time, mistletoe and wine, children singing Christian rhyme, with logs on the fire, gifts on the tree.
What are they doing on the tree?
A time to in the good that we see.
A time to... A time to
be thankful for the good. No,
yeah,
no.
But if you're that down,
not that word.
No, it's like you'd throw your arms out and go, we.
To
rhymes with free moist.
Rhymes with whom?
I know. Oh, I'm not getting this one. How do I? I can't. It's a really hard one
to
clue up.
A time to no, it wouldn't be too long a word anyway. Sure, it wouldn't.
No.
That song.
No.
Time to love.
What's the famous Galway name? It's Shoga in Irish. Do you know what that is in English?
Shoga.
No.
I can't even think of a famous
person.
I can't. Shulukas. Time to not embrace, not love, not hold.
No, but when you want to indulge yourself in something to celebrate, to say yes, we all have to be so happy about
joy.
This. Yeah, well, kind of
joyful.
You know, yeah, it's in there. When you do something again, you do
be joyful.
When you do something again, you it's like a oh, this is a torture. Okay, just say rejoice.
A time to rejoice.
That's the answer. Yes, thank you. Question for you is, here's George Michael and the other fella, also known as Wham. Little did they know back then that this line would be quite so relevant these days. So have a listen and tell me the missing word.
Once bitten and twice shy.
Social.
Distance.
Oh, fantastic, Mr. Fox. Well, that is it from this week's... Oh, that is just too much fun. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.